This talk is about long-range prosody prediction and rhythm. Work was done mostly at Oxford by myself and Anastasia Lukina, Eleanor Keane, Qilin Shi, who's at the University of Illinois, and Burton Rosner. Another title for the talk could be Doing Rhythm with Fewer Assumptions. Now, if we're talking about detecting or measuring rhythm, we're talking about building a system, a piece of software that does the job. And that gives us two choices. We can talk about what do we train the system on if we're building a data-driven system, or what is rhythm if we're directly writing code that measures rhythm. Well, what do we train it on? Most people train their systems on low-pass filtered speech. People also will build systems that depend on duration measurements. Now, low-pass filtered speech was originally proposed to simulate the acoustic environment that the human fetus hears. Except, someone had actually done the experiment with fetal sheep. They put a microphone in a pregnant ewe and measured what the fetus could hear. Then the crucial bit is here in red. It's that above 250 Hz, sound attenuation increased at the rate of 6 decibels per octave. It's a one-pole filter. It's not a steep filter. It doesn't really cut off the high frequencies too strongly. And in fact, you can hear and understand speech very well through a one-pole filter like that. So the fetus is developing an environment where it can hear all the distinctions it could hear outside the womb. But what do we typically train these systems on? We train them on low-pass filtered speech with a fourth order or steeper cutoff designed explicitly to delexicalize it, to make it impossible to determine the segmental information. So we train these systems on an impoverished environment compared to what the fetus gets. Let me give you an example of what this sounds like. Here's The Stars and Stripes Forever, performed by the U.S. Marine Corps Band.
This is your basic march. It's a dull, thumpy thing, or so it seems in the low-pass filter. And couldn't you feel the sheer emotional impact of one of the best-known American marches? Perhaps some of you with good imaginations and sharp ears could. As we can hear, there's a certain amount of rhythm and emotional impact in the upper registers, too. You miss that with a low-pass filter. That was a thumpy section we heard at first, and you can hear that the beats are not uniform, that they're an alternation between two clusters of instruments, so you'd get a different metrical pattern by looking at the whole signal than you would by looking at the low-frequency part.
So, rhythm, as defined by a low-pass filter, is a much simpler, less interesting thing than rhythm in reality. And yet, we build our systems that way. Well, the other kind of thing that people train their systems on are they train their systems on duration measurements and attempt to make them discriminate between languages. The logic of this is pretty straightforward. Phonology and phonotactics are basic properties of each language, and the language also specifies stress and prominence. And all of these properties affect the duration of sounds. Therefore, rhythm should be a property of a language. Except that each step above is an approximation, and there are also other things that affect rhythm. So overall, it doesn't work all that well. Let me talk about some results we got this summer in Lukina et al., presented at InterSpeech 2009. It's a large study of rhythm measures. We used 62 subjects and 2,253 paragraphs. We did automatic segmentation because it was too much data to do by hand. And we tried more than 1,000 two-way and three-way combinations of the published rhythm measures. The figure here shows you pretty much what's going on, and what's going on is that there's a lot of variation from paragraph to paragraph and from speaker to speaker. The red dots, for instance, are Chinese, and the blue dots are Greek, and what you see is that by and large you can separate Chinese from most other languages, but if you look carefully, you'll find some Chinese paragraphs are right next to Greek paragraphs. In other words, a single paragraph's worth of data is not sufficient to tell the difference from one language to the next using published rhythm measures. And that's because you'll find that each person speaks in their own way, so that you have some speakers of Russian who sound very English, some speakers of Greek who sound very French, and also because each paragraph has its own properties. And some English paragraphs will have rhythms closer to Russian, or some English paragraph will have a rhythm closer to Chinese. Put those together, and you see that an individual paragraph is not sufficient to tell the difference between languages. And yet, many papers use data from just a single paragraph, a single speaker, to draw conclusions about a language. So, the other way we could build a system is we could program a definition of rhythm into our algorithm. But where do we get a definition of rhythm? Expert opinion provides some, but we don't really want to get expert opinions. For one thing, experts read papers about what the answer should be, and experts defer to each other, so their opinions are not independent. Also, of course, experts don't provide answers for all languages before the data appears. So to my knowledge, no one has discussed the rhythm of Croatian, and no one really has an opinion on whether it's syllable-timed, stress-timed, or mora-timed. Well, we could ask naive native speakers. They have many advantages. But how do you ask them? How do you tell them what rhythm is so you can ask them what rhythm is? And can they do the task? It's not an easy task to ignore certain parts of speech and to pay attention to others. Overall, the field is not entirely satisfactory. A lot of the original assumptions have failed the test, but they're still there as part of our techniques, and they often form the core of our introductions. So, we decided to start from scratch with as few assumptions as possible. Starting from scratch, we came upon poetry. Many cultures, perhaps even most cultures, have some rhythmic form of poetry, nursery rhymes, for instance. And when they do have nursery rhymes, for instance, everyone agrees that they're rhythmic, everyone agrees that they're poetry, and everyone agrees that they have a meter. In other words, they're predictable. So we will use poetry. Here's an example of something with a meter and predictable, and I'm going to use this to show how important predictability is to our brains. This is, again, from the Stars and Stripes Forever, otherwise known as Be Kind to Your Web-Footed Friends. It's a comedy routine from the 1920s.
Be kind to your web-footed friends, for a duck may be somebody's uncle. Be kind to your friends in the swamp, where the weather is cold and damp. Now you may think this is the end. Well, it is.
That's quite a jolt there, when it just stops. Your brain is in the middle of a bunch of rhythm and meter, and it's keeping track of what's going on, and it's heard it all before, and it's expecting to hear it all again, and then suddenly it doesn't. So, it's a rhythmically predictable passage. You figured out what's coming next, and you're right, all the way up to the end, when the song violates all the predictions, and suddenly ceases to be rhythmical. So, our general strategy for starting from scratch is to find rhythmic poetry, get native speakers to read it. The resulting audio is typically rhythmic. We do the same thing as a comparison set, control set, with ordinary text. And if rhythm is predictability, we should be able to do a better job of predicting what comes next in the poetry. So we use four poems, each of 8 to 12 lines, in Southern British English, Parisian French, Standard Modern Greek, Standard Russian, and Taiwanese Mandarin. Speakers weren't really told how to read them. They weren't told to read them with a strong rhythm. But they typically did, anyway. The prose paragraphs, the control set, are translations of Harry Potter, chosen for another experiment. They're about a minute long, 2,328 utterances. They're recorded in the same session as the poetry, with the same language and same speakers. Data preparation. Rereads were allowed until people were happy with the paragraphs. 20% of the paragraphs were repeated. Word-level transcriptions were manually fixed, and phone-level transcriptions were derived from an automated system and then manually repaired as needed. In the data analysis, we segmented speech into consonantal, silence, and vocalic regions. We compute acoustic properties for each segment. We build a predictor for the properties, and then we evaluate each predictor. The segmentation is a strictly language-independent design. Here, we're being language-independent because we're trying to compare languages, and we want to be able to separate differences in the segmentation from differences in the languages themselves. We use an automatic segmenter because of the volume of data. It's a speech recognition system, effectively. It's trained on our subjects, trained on 36 manually segmented minutes of speech. It has a standard MFCC front end, and it recognizes only three phones: consonantal, vocalic, and silence. Those three phones are common to all languages, at least all languages that we know of. And then, in each segment, we compute 10 acoustic properties. One is the duration of a segment. Three of them are loudness-related properties, including how loud is it, how long is it, is the loudness early or late, standard deviation of the loudness across the segment. We do the same with a partial voicing property, which is essentially how much frication noise is there amongst the voiced speech. We ask how close the spectrum is to the average speech sound. The average speech sound for English is sort of schwa-like. So you can think of this, for vowels at any rate, as the vowel quality. And then there are two properties based on the rate of spectral change. In other words, if you look at the spectrum now and a little bit later, has there been a major change in the spectrum in between? These are sort of related to speech rate. So we build predictors. We pick where we want to predict. So we ask ourselves, are we predicting for a consonantal, a vocalic, or a silent segment? Is the target segment phrase initial, phrase medial, or phrase final? And which of these 10 properties should we predict? And then, how much historical context should we allow for the prediction? And then, of course, which language? And is it prose or poetry? So you end up with a lot of predictors. Now, how much context? This is poetry, and poetry can have a complicated rhyme scheme. Here's an example that we used for English. In winter, I get up at night and dress by yellow candlelight. In summer, quite the other way, I have to go to bed by day. I have to go to bed and see the birds still hopping in the tree. If you have the preceding line, that will tell you a lot about the line you're looking at. I have to go to bed and see tells you a lot about the birds still hopping on the tree. So, that's 8 syllables. In our data, 8 syllables is about 16 segments, because we defined consonantal to be an entire string of consonants. Almost all syllables from our point of view here are CV. So if you have 16 segments, that will let you predict directly from the previous line. But even with less than that, you can get a lot of information. 2 syllables, about 4 phones, 4 segments, will make the stress determination much more reliable. You'll have seen a stressed syllable and an unstressed syllable, and you can predict what comes next. Even 1 syllable, that is about 2 phones, will tell you something. So we'd like a lot of context. For practical reasons, we stop 8 segments. What is a predictor? Well, here, it's a linear equation that predicts the desired acoustic property in terms of all 10 acoustic properties of the preceding syllables. So, if we're predicting, say, the duration at time t, we have a constant, and that constant actually depends on the subject. And we're using information on d, t minus 1, i.e. the preceding value of duration, and preceding value of other properties, like the loudness, the mean loudness of the preceding syllable. And then we have C11 times dt minus 2. We're going back 2 syllables, 2 segments rather, and looking at the duration, and 2 segments, we're looking at lt minus 2, and so forth. These predictors can be fairly long. They could have up to 80 or so coefficients. And each one is predicting a single property, and we train it in one of these classes of syllables, like phrase final consonants in English. How do you evaluate a predictor? Use standard statistical tools. Pearson's R-squared tells you how well it predicts. R-squared is the fraction of total variance that is correctly predicted. Here's an example where we have predicted and actual values. They form a nice straight line. It's completely predictable. Here's another example where R-squared is 0. There's no predictability. The predicted value isn't related to the actual value. Then what? There are 320 predictors for poetry or prose in each language. We ran each one 10 times, each with a new bootstrap sample of the data. That's a statistical technique that allows us to see if values of R squared, some values of R squared are just lucky accidents in a regression. and then we made histograms of R squared. A lot of linear regressions here. So, can we tell poetry from prose with this technique? Definitely yes. In this plot here, we have Pearson's R squared across the bottom, going from unpredictable on the left to fully predictable on the right. Prose is on top, poetry is on the bottom, and you can see that most of the prose values are reasonably predictable. And we can see that most of these predictors, remember, each dot on this histogram is an entirely different linear regression, predicting different things with a different equation. Most of these equations are fairly good predictors, giving you Pearson's R squared of about 0.2 or 0.3. They explain 20 or 30% of the variance. But for poetry, we find, shockingly, almost never you see this in speech and language, we find some things predicting almost 100% of the variance. Some aspects of poetry are very predictable. So, almost all these predictors are statistically significantly better for poetry than prose, and the effect sizes are huge. Poetry is generally twice as predictable as prose is. Now, this is science here, and we are going to take the opportunity to make a prediction and test it. There aren't more than a few people in this room who actually know the answer to it, so I'm hoping they keep quiet and the rest of you guess. I'm going to tell you two stories about whether English or French poetry should be more predictable, and you get to choose. Story number one is that English is a typical stress-timed language. Given lexical stress, it should have a strong alternation in properties on the iambic trochaic feet. Bum, 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 bum. It ought to be easily predictable, being an alternation. French is a typical syllable-timed language. It should have relatively little difference from syllable to syllable. Smaller differences will be hidden more by normal variation, and therefore, properties of French syllables will be less predictable. So story one says that English poetry should be more predictable than French. Story two, of course, says the reverse. French does have something like stress. At least it behaves acoustically like stress, but it's determined by position in the phrase, not the word. So it should be completely predictable, although perhaps not too strong an effect because there aren't that many of these phrasal stresses. English has stress, but English poetry doesn't always follow a perfect meter. So it should be fairly predictable, but maybe not perfectly predictable. Therefore, in this story, French poetry might well be more predictable than English. Hands up for which you believe. Well, it turns out that French poetry is rather more predictable than English. English is the top line here, and the horizontal axis is as before. It's Pearson's R squared, ranging from 0, which means unpredictable, to 1, meaning that a given predictor works very, very well. English poetry pops out at about 75% predictable, and most of it is in the neighborhood of 40 to 50%. But French poetry, oh, the French. They have quite a number of predictors that work at near 100%, and the average predictability is probably 0.6 or so, I'm guessing. So, do we know why that's true? No. But one of the beauties of an experiment is you can find out what the right answer is, and you can test your theories. And you can see here that the theories aren't really sufficient to make a real prediction. Now, you can see a few things from this plot. One is that in all the languages, English at the top, Russian, French, Chinese, Greek, that poetry is more predictable than prose by a substantial factor, even English. And you can see that there are differences from language to language. English poetry is probably the least predictable. Chinese poetry is next, followed by Old Greek, and then French and Russian poetry are quite predictable. And you can see some differences in the predictability of prose, too. Russian and French and Chinese have a second hump at around R squared equals 0.25, whereas English and Greek don't. The other thing we can look at is how much history matters. Remember, some of these predictors use a long history of up to 8 segments, and other predictors use, in fact, no segments, just knowledge of the subject to predict what's going to be going on in the next segment. This plot here is the same as before on the bottom axis, Pearson's R squared ranging from 0 to 1. Here we split the predictors by the amount of history involved, ranging from 0 history, just knowledge of the subject, on the top line, down to 8 segments of history on the bottom line, about 4 syllables on the bottom line. And what you see is that things get better. Not surprising. You use more history, you pick up more information about the past, and in poetry that lets you predict the future. In prose, it lets you predict the future, too, although, interestingly enough, things stop getting better. If you look at the blue, in 0 to 1 to 2 to 3, the predictions are better and better, but when you get up to 4, they're really not much better, and 5 and 6 and 7 are about the same. So, prose only can make use of a little bit of history, because prose does not have long-range patterns. Prose is intrinsically unpredictable at long distances. Poetry, on the other hand, the red here, just keeps on getting better. 0, history to 1, to 2, to 3, to 4, history continuously improving. 5, history, we're starting to get a number of predictors coming up near 100%. 6 and 7 and 8, more and more end up there. So poetry intrinsically uses long-range information, because poetry has long-range metrical patterns. Now, final quiz. Which class of syllables should be more predictable in poetry? Phrase initial, phrase medial, or phrase final? A phrase is defined by a pause, and what usually means is that phrase is a line in the poetry we used. Phrase initial is predicting the first syllable of line. Phrase final is predicting the last syllable line. Medial is predicting anything in between. I should say segment, of course. We can look at this. Anyone have a prediction? All right. What you find is those of you who picked phrase final are the winners. Phrase final syllables are much more predictable. Phrase initial syllables, interestingly enough, are also fairly predictable, even though we're predicting across the gap. Even though we're predicting across the gap between lines, we're predicting the beginning of a line from the latter half of the preceding line. And phrase medial are least predictable. Poetry is only a little bit easier to predict there than prose. That's a very interesting result, and not one that I understand completely at the moment. So, in conclusion, I hope you agree that this is a powerful technique, and it's capable of producing unexpected results already, so we have the opportunity of learning something about rhythm that we didn't put into the technique. Thank you.